Welcome back to the Football Fitness Federation podcast. This is episode 283. This episode is with Dr. Steve Thompson. Steve is a senior lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University in strength conditioning. He's also worked with Barnsley Football Club in a lead S&C role with their academy, and is also doing some work with the Welsh FA with their under-19s women's team as well. So it was great to get Steve on. Steve spoke for us a few months ago now at our event at Sheffield Wednesday that we ran, and he presented on velocity-based training. So that is part of the podcast that we go into. That's part of the topic that we go into today on the podcast. We start with his experience with international squads and club teams, some of the differences and different approach he has to take with those two different squads. Then we talk about the specialist generalist approach and have a little discussion around what Steve's experiences have been on that. Should we specialise in a certain area or should we focus on being a generalist? And Steve's someone that's great to get his opinion on this one, because he's been in both camps and continues to be in both camps, not to give it away completely. But yeah, there's some great advice from Steve on this area as well. Then we talk about something that I think is going to be massively beneficial to everybody listening: velocity-based training, but how it's applied across different levels. So regardless of what you've got available to you within your squads, whether you've got all the equipment, all the financial backing, that's great. If you haven't, there's also ways of working, and Steve covers that really nicely for everyone in regards to velocity-based training. He talks about the use of it within football, how we can apply it efficiently. He talks about the gamification of training as well, which is something that Ben Rosenblatt spoke about in his episode not that long back. Creating buy-in, intent and competition with players, but also some challenges in terms of the application of velocity-based training as well. So there's plenty coming in this episode. It's a really exciting time coming up for our networking event, because actually, the day this podcast goes out, we're going to be at Goodison Park. So we're going to have presentations from James Malone and James Coneboy, both previously been on the podcast. But the following week, Wednesday the 27th of March, from 6 till 9pm, we are at the Hawthorns, West Brom. We've got Angela Jackson presented alongside Barry Druss, so brilliant presenters at that event. And then on Thursday the 11th of April, from 6 till 9pm, we are over in Dublin, and we've got Paul McGrath and Shane Malone presenting for us over at that event. So you can go and check out tickets for those events. They're all still available. Go to footballfitfed.com, click the shop, and then networking events. That section, you'll be able to access tickets. And for any community members listening, we are going to be doing the very first live stream of the events at West Brom and in Dublin as well. So if you're not able to make it to those events, we're going to be running it through our members only WhatsApp group. So you will get live, you always get recorded access to the presentations, but you're actually going to get live access of the event, the ability to ask questions and engage with the presentations as well and the presenters. So keep an eye out for that if you are a community member. Just before we jump into the episode, I want to say a massive thank you to our sponsors, The Good Prep. The Good Prep is a meal prep delivery service that provides fresh, ready-to-eat, chef-cooked meals straight to your door. They offer meal plans tailored to your personal goals, current activity level and schedule. The Good Prep works closely with elite-level athletes and corporates to develop meal solutions that meet the ever-changing demands of performance and training. Their clients include Brighton & Hove Albion, PGMOL, Commonwealth Teams, Gymshark and many more. Their meals are full of all the nutrients you need to keep you in peak performance so you can achieve every goal you set. Plus, you can reclaim your time, eat better, move more, and reduce food waste too. Their meal plans are designed to guide you through your journey to a healthier you. Take the guesswork out of healthy eating and discover the power of nutrition at thegoodprep.com, and make sure you use the code FFF15 for 15% off your first order. This podcast is brought to you by Hytro, the number one BFR brand in pro sport, helping teams and athletes improve performance and recover faster with their blood flow restriction wearables. Built for sport and proven by science, check out hytro.com to find out more. And also a massive thank you to our longest serving sponsors, that is Rezl, the world's leading VR sports trainer. Make sure you go and check them out on X and Instagram at Rezl. Go and see some of the work that they are doing. A certain Marcus Rashford has been using Rezl recently, so go and see the video that they've put out with him. And let's get into the episode now. Episode 283 with senior lecturer and S&C coach, Dr. Steve Thompson.
Rezl is the world's number one virtual reality sports trainer. Whatever your team, your sport, your ability, improve your game and train like a pro. Rezl. Reactions, performance, accuracy, stamina, resilience. Train at home in the Rezl Sports and Fitness VR Training Arena. Search Rezl, R-E-Z-Z-I-L. Harder, stronger, smarter. The world's number one virtual reality sports trainer. Available now on MetaQuest.
Welcome back to the Football Fitness Federation podcast. This is episode 283. I'm delighted to welcome on to the podcast today, Steve Thompson. Steve, how are we doing?
Hi, Ben. Yeah, really good. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all, mate. It's been, obviously, we caught up yesterday, actually, to talk about what we're going to speak about on the podcast. But anyone who came to our event at Chef Wednesday, which is a little bit ago now, would have seen, come across yourself.
Yeah. What was it? Back in... Was it before Christmas when it started? Sort of started this year.
Yeah, it was. It was a little while ago.
It was really nice to. It was a really good event. Obviously, you know, your live events have got a really good reputation, so it's great to be able to contribute to one of them. And even better to kind of hopefully reach a wider audience through the podcast today and delve into the world of VBT, which I like to do quite a lot.
100%. No, it'd be great to pick your brains on it in a second, and I know. A lot of what we're going to talk around is the application of VBT across different levels. So people working with different squads, like I said, different levels. You're going to take plenty away from this, like they did anyone that was at the event. So, but we'll start in the same place as we usually do. Let's find out a little bit more about yourself, your journey, what you're up to now.
Cool. Yeah. So I suppose a relatively traditional approach to kind of getting into the world of S&C and sports science. Did an undergrad at 2006, 2009, and then a master's straight after that at Sheffield Hallam. At that time, there were no, might have been one or two specific MSCs in strength and conditioning. So mine was a bit more of a generic sport and exercise science master's. And then following that, did an internship at Nottingham Trent University with a company called Sport 981, who think are still going now, I'm not sure actually, but that was a really good experience for a year, kind of immersing myself in sort of university sport. Had some really great mentors, people that, you know, I'm still in contact with now, to kind of bounce ideas off and stuff. So that was really, really good. And then moved pretty quickly back into academia. Worked as a technician for a few years while I sort of figured out what I wanted to do and where I wanted to be. Dipped my toe in coaching and kind of that world a little bit, and then sort of fell into academia and lecturing. But alongside that, you know, that was sort of 2015, was able to maintain up my coaching and lots of other things. So I suppose the beauty of working at universities, you get a lot of variety in roles and responsibilities, and you get quite a lot of flexibility. So I was able to actually carve out a pretty decent coaching career alongside teaching and researching, which has been really cool. So from a coaching perspective, I've probably dabbled in most sports, really, through consultancy packages through the university, but also through some external work that I've done in different fields. So longest roles and contracts that I've had through the university, we've worked with the City of Sheffield Diving for about 10 years now, and they we work with their performance squad, with which the majority of those are sort of in the GB British Diving setup. So worked with Olympic competitors, European world champions, Commonwealth medalists over those 10 years. And obviously, most recently, we're gearing up for Paris, so we hope we're going to have one or two of our team going to Paris as well, which would be which would be awesome to see because they work their asses off, to be fair to them. So yeah, they deserve that shot. And then I've spent a lot of time in football as well. So I worked sort of eight or nine seasons part time at Barnsley Football Club. Pretty much worked my way through different roles in that space. So started off as a foundation coach, and then went up into the YDP phase, and then sort of the final couple of years, I then ended up heading up the YDP and the foundation phases, writing the curriculum, overseeing the delivery, the interns, and just kind of making sure that side of the academy ran as well as it could do. And then, yeah, most recently, over the past sort of 18 to 24 months, started working for the Football Association of Wales, so working on the women's pathway as physical performance coach with their under-19 squad. I have worked with some of the younger squads, but yeah, my main role is now under-19s. And long may that continue.
Brilliant. I want to get into that in a second with you work with Wales, but just before we do that, in terms of the academia and the coaching, was there always an intention, you sort of said about falling into academia, was there always an intention of keeping that split, of doing a bit of both?
Yeah, I think so. Like when I graduated and then did that internship, I definitely had a passion for strength and conditioning, but it was definitely a time where jobs were few and far between. You were looking at like the EIS as it was back then, or sort of smaller organisations. It certainly wasn't as big as it is now in the amount of roles you can apply for. And yeah, I kind of just fell into academia through needing a job. I applied for different coaching roles. Technician role came up. Thought, okay, that sounds interesting. Good opportunity to sort of being around some smart people and you know, continue to learn the trade. And it kind of then just as S&C curriculum developed within academia and courses and modules were developed, because I had that S&C background, I was UKSCA accredited, I did have, you know, little bits of coaching experience here and there, that I was kind of a good fit for delivering that curriculum and that content. And then, you know, after 6 months, I was offered a full-time role within as a lecturer, and I sort of didn't want to pass it up. So, and then that's kind of, yeah, that's the rest is history, as they say. So it what it did was it afforded me an opportunity to continue to coach whilst doing something else, which I really, really liked. And like I said, that flexibility of academia can be really, really positive for, and they can be really supportive in those extracurricular sort of roles and jobs and stuff, because obviously we can raise our own profiles as staff, and that has a positive impact on the university and the course and the department, etc.
I was going to touch on that. So I was going to ask around each role complementing one another. And I think the obvious one is being involved in coaching and then stepping into academia, obviously being able to talk about like real life circumstances. Well, if we switch that, has there been big compliments from the academia side into coaching as well?
Yeah, I think the obvious and biggest impact is the research side of things. Being within academia, one thing I didn't mention was I completed a PhD in velocity-based training, low velocity profiling in 2022. So I was doing that for 5.5 years alongside all the other stuff.
I like how you left that out. Is that trying to blank it out the mind, or
that
small detail?
I'm very rubbish at talking about myself, so when it comes to listening to me, something always falls out of my head. But no, so that kind of, because of the requirements of the roles within academia, I was very much ingrained in the research, whether that's from a VBT perspective or just from any kind of topic that we're teaching, we have to be researching informed, whether that's us doing it ourselves or being informed of what else is out there of contemporary literature. So whilst I understand that there is often a discrepancy between practice and research, from my perspective, the research was able to feed directly into some of the things that I was doing in the applied world, which I think it has to work that way. You know, obviously, feet on the ground, real world experience is there's nothing like it. I mean, I'm not saying research would ever replace that, but I think research has a place in practice and in the applied space, and I think that the best practitioners are able to use their experience, their feeling, and their gut, but also sort of marry that up to what the literature's saying and trying to stay as up to date with that as they possibly can do, to sort of get the best of both worlds. Really.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's good advice. I want to just get your experiences now on the whole sort of club and national team differences. So you work with, obviously you mentioned you work with Barnsley, you've mentioned you work with Wales as well. What have been some of the differences for you as a practitioner in terms of your approach? Because we're talking more camp style meetups for the Welsh girls. And then obviously in terms of with Barnsley, it was more consistent contact, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose there's quite a few nuances, really. Obviously, from a programming and delivery perspective, the consistency within the club environment meant that there was probably more opportunities to make change and to really impact the players from a physical perspective. So I was in twice a week delivering to the same squad twice a week for the full season until they then either moved up to the professional development phase or were released or whatever. So you really get to know the players and you really get to then figure out what works and what doesn't. And there's consistency there and there's progression in from week to week. And, you know, I had myself and other people that worked at the club had some really great success with certain things with certain players. You know, it was quite a good track record of players going through the academy and getting some experience within the first team. There's two or three players now that I coached when they will have been under 14s or 15s that are now in the first team. So that, as a journey, is incredible, you know, to see that and see those players doing really well, knowing that you played that small part at some point in their development. And on the flip side of that, then, from the international perspective, is exactly what you said. You're seeing the players maybe 5-6 times a year. And within that, often it's based around fixtures. So you might have a 10-day camp. Within that 10 days, you've got 3 games. So actually the physical development comes, but certainly for those starters and those that are playing the more minutes, comes within that game setup, really.
Yeah.
We're then just managing load, managing recovery, managing all the other things to make sure that they're then ready to go again in 2 days' time. So whilst, you know, there's some really cool research out there on things like microdosing, and I know the English FA do that really, really well. Whilst there are opportunities to develop and get some physical stimulus into the players, certainly from my experience, that is, you know, a lot less than it would be in club football. And you're just trying to, you're picking out these little pockets of opportunities to get some stimulus in, get some education in from any kind of perspective, nutrition, recovery, or an actual physical development, whether that's in the gym, on the field, you know, managing the GPS and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, the environments are completely different. You know, not one better than the other, just different.
I spoke to a lot of people, obviously on the men's side, that are in national team roles similar to yourself. And obviously a lot of their work within that period is guided by information that they're getting from clubs. So how do you find that? So we're talking under 19s, the women's, on the women's side, I'm guessing they're going to be within, a lot of them are going to be within academies as well. So how is that in terms of the programming? What do they bring with them? Is that sort of something, an area that needs developing, or is it set in place now?
Yeah, I think it's probably, it's in progress, I would say. So, you know, there are some there are clubs out there that do it really, really well, and then there are other clubs that perhaps are just that little bit under-resourced or you know, unsure of that process fully. So the information that we can get from clubs can be quite varied. So, and actually within the FAW, they, over the past 5 or 6 years, they set up their own academy, recognizing that actually the environments that a lot of the players were in weren't necessarily fit for purpose to then prepare them for senior international women's football. Mm. So they made a decision to set up two academies in the south and in the north, and therefore they're in much more of a club setting. So the players that come up from, you know, within that setting that then go onto the international camps, are a lot more versed and understand the kind of that typical professional approach, if you will, that the men's game has been doing for so many years, and the women's game is, you know, increasing exponentially, and like it won't be long until they're all there, and there's parity between the two sectors, but they're just, yeah, there's just that little bit of catch up, I think, to do.
To relate that back to you within your role with that squad, though, if you've got players that you're getting quite varied information about, so if you've got a player that's coming with a program, you've got maybe some recent testing data and all the rest of it, compared to another player that hasn't got any of that, how does that impact your approach you take with the players?
Yeah, so we typically, what we would do is we would have conversations with the players to see where they're at. So we would log loading over the past 7 days. Typically, you know, clubs are pretty good at least telling us how many minutes they played, what kind of sessions they've had. And then when we get them in, I will then deliver a program that fits the needs of that camp, essentially. So we don't have players coming in and undertaking their own strength program, for example. Because fitting that in and around the schedule, which is pretty hectic anyway, and managing that is sometimes difficult. So the way we might run a strength S&C sort of gym program is we might just do sort of that microdosing approach where 15 to 20 minutes prior to going on field, we do some form of gym session that's then going to complement that on-field session. So if it's max velocity, you know, we'll be doing some vertical force development, we'll be doing some sort of calf tissue conditioning and some reactivity, some drop jumps, something like that, just to prime them, get a physical stimulus, but more so prime them for what we're then going to go out and do on the field. So, yeah, I think we try to make everything as standardized as we can from player to player, apart from any player that's, let's say, come in on it, we're going in on a Monday and they've played 90 minutes on a Sunday, then that would be their plus one. So we might then have a bit of a broken session where we might have some players not training and some players training based on that sort of load management.
Yeah. Class. I think you're someone great to bring up this debate around, because if we talk around the specialist versus the generalist, you've already spoke there about both sides, because we've talked about the specialist area in terms of EBT, which I know we'll go into a little bit more in a second. But you've also touched on, with a great example just there, around this generalist approach. You've got to be adaptive. You're working with different players, different scenarios, different skill sets. What is your experience with the specialist and the generalist, and where do you feel that you fit? Do you feel like you lean? Is it more like a sliding scale where you can go from one side to the other?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I would definitely class myself as more of a generalist than a specialist in that sense, just from my experience. You know, I've never really been in an environment that's facilitated that real specialist kind of focus. Yes, BBT is probably the area that I know the most about and that I'm the most knowledgeable and experienced within. But even then, I was never a VBT specialist for the club or the organization. It was I would do things that kind of complemented what I was doing within that setting. So I would definitely fall in the generalist category. But I certainly think it's important to try and carve out a specialism for yourself, whatever environment you're in, because that can always be a, you know, a bit of a an arsenal for you, in a sense of, you know, I can do all these roles and I can cover everything, but actually I'm really good at this. So for me, kind of the profiling, the physical performance evaluation, that kind of stuff, I would say is my specialist area, if anyone was to ask. But it's not necessarily something that I've been able to really pursue to that degree, just because of, you know, the roles I'm typically working with from a coaching perspective are part-time roles, because I'm full-time within a university. So it's difficult to kind of implement specialisms when you may be only there for a 10-day camp and then you're not there for another 2 months, or you're there 2 nights a week and trying to manage kind of all the other things. But yeah, I think, you know, we obviously had a conversation with Ben Rosenblatt not so long ago, and the FA are one of those organizations that do that very, very well. You know, they've got a team of generalists, but then all have their separate specialists, and it just helps to drive that program forward. So I think that's definitely the stronger option, I think, in terms of when you become a coach, is if you can understand the wider scale, but then have that niche as well.
I think you referenced it before. Obviously, you gave the example there with Ben, but you referenced it before from the university's perspective as well, that if you're going out and upskilling in that area and then taking it into the applied side, that it's only going to benefit either the club in the club scenario or the university in the university scenario as well. And a really cringe phrase, which I'm not quite sure is right to use here, but in terms of like a personal brand, it's what you, if you're focusing on a certain area, upskilling in that area, maybe becoming known in that area, but knowing at the same time you can step into and become that generalist, it's sort of that makes you stick out in a crowd. And I think for coaches in general, I think that's really good advice for people, isn't it? To get known. And the amount of people now trying to get these opportunities when they come up, we've got to do something, haven't we, to stand out?
Yeah, exactly. And then it's kind of some of the messages that we'll give to my students, for example. I'm lucky enough to course lead our MSc, so I get to work at sort of teach and collaborate with some really passionate students who know exactly where they want to be, you know, whether that's get to the UKSI, get to a professional football club, rugby club, or start their own personal brand, as you mentioned. So we you know, we try to kind of give them that guidance of, you know, you have to be able to do the role, whatever that role is, you have to be able to pick all those boxes. But to become known, if you want to build your profile, easier to do that with a specialism than trying to become known as the best generalist in the world. I don't know if anyone would ever kind of qualify someone as that. Mm. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are excellent, excellent generalists who can do everything really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, you think of some of the specialists out there, you know, Jonas Dodu and Speedworks and Speed Development, Alan Murdoch and Change of Direction, now kind of that rehab space. They're all known because of those specialisms. It's definitely it's a strong thing to be able to try and develop.
Yeah, 100%. No, that's great. I think there's a lot of key advice in there for coaches. Let's move into the world of VBT, which I know that we could talk about this forever. And I know you're excited already to get involved into it. But it was great, obviously, when you agreed to come on, because I know we could expand. The presentation you did with us benefited a hell of a lot of people because of the fact that you spoke about it being applied at different levels, different resources, different situations within different clubs, different sort of contact time with players. There was everything covered. So I want to start with that, really, in terms of applying VBT at different levels. Can it be done? And what does that look like?
Yeah, of course. So I think the best place to start with this is the whole, and I probably said this in the presentation that we did in face-to-face, and I've said it a few different times, but the whole argument around best practice within anything, but you know, specifically in DVT. And from my perspective, best practice can only really fit the environment that you're trying to fit it into. So if you're a coach who works with one individual 4 times a week and you have endless resources and budget, your best practice is going to be very much the end of that spectrum, which is an immersive DBT approach where you're testing, monitoring, feedback, programming, volume control, fatigue control. Everything can be driven by that data. Flip side of that, you know, use me as an example. You're working with a squad for 45 minutes twice a week. The chances of you being able to be that immersive are very, very slim. So then you're going back to the other end of that scale and you're thinking, right, well, what are the things that I can do that are bang for your buck, plug and play, so easy to set up and you don't need any prior kind of testing or information. It's just put on the device and let's get going. What are those things? And from my perspective, there's two or three things that we can do that can really complement a program, drive a program forward, get some really good responses from it, and still work within those constraints, those time and those budgetary constraints that I've just mentioned. Those three elements for me, and I know we're going to delve into each one, would be feedback. So providing some velocity-based feedback within a session. There would be simple monitoring and testing that often gets overlooked. And then there would be either an implementation of something like velocity loss, however, is still on the more complex side, or go delving back into the research like we've already discussed and sort of saying, you know, there's plenty of research out there now that shows you in key exercises within different populations what sort of velocities you might be getting at different percentages of 1RMs. There's no reason why you can't be clever, take that information, move away from the profiling and all the invasive stuff and start to implement it that way, particularly if time is restricted, which often it is in most spaces.
I mentioned it in the episode already, but Steve presented at our event at Sheffield Wednesday. And that presentation, along with many other presentations and webinars, is available to go and watch right now on our online community. He presented on velocity-based training, practical insights and applications, and it was exactly that. Everything he spoke about in this podcast, but backed up with visuals and going into more detail and everything, giving you some real precise information to carry into your role and the use of VBT within your role as well. So you can go and check that out now. If you're not already a community member, go to footballfitfed.com, click the community tab, sign yourself up there, and it'll give you a 30-day free trial of the community. After that free trial, you become a fully paid member of the community and you get invited into our members-only WhatsApp group where we have weekly discussions on different subjects and performance questions that have come up within different people's roles. Plus, we are going to be live streaming some of our events into that group as well. So come and join footballfitfed.com, click the community tab and sign up today for a free 30-day trial. Here's part two of the podcast with Steve Thompson. Yeah, I know it's a massive benefit and I don't want to teach people to sort of suck eggs with this, because I know there'll be a lot of people implementing VBT with squads that they're working with. I think the main thing of this discussion is to give them ideas on how it can be improved, how the efficiency can be improved within their practice as well. And I know you've seen it being done or being used in different scenarios now as well. What have been some of the reflections and lessons that you've taken from the different scenarios that you've seen it being used?
Yeah, I think the biggest impact you can have with VBT and obviously certainly from my experience within football, and I know that this is a common experience that practitioners that I've spoken to that have tried to implement VBT, that the biggest impact you can have is from the feedback. So just providing, giving the players the devices, setting them up, giving them a different focus to consider for the sessions, and creating some intent, some competition. So essentially, whatever device you're using, you're going to get some live numbers. You're going to get some live velocities, whether that's mean, peak, mean pulsive. Again, it depends on what you're focusing on as to which one you maybe want to use. But you're going to get that live if you've got enough devices and if you set up the gym in a way that complements sort of different stations, then you can then get athletes to chase is probably the wrong word, but pay attention to the velocity that they're lifting at as opposed to the loads on the bar.
Yeah.
Actually, from things that I've seen, from experiences that I've had and from different clubs doing it in different ways, what you actually find is when they start to think more about the speed of the lift, the loading takes care of itself. Because there's always been this stereotype, rightfully or wrongfully, because there's always going to be a mix of players, where they don't necessarily like to lift heavy, don't always see the value in lifting heavy, concerned that it's going to mess up the next day, it's going to leave them sore, etc., etc. And I found that changing that focus from, okay, well, we're not really going to worry about what's on the bar, it's not how much is on the bar now, it's how quickly you can move something, and then we can start to give you specific velocity targets, for example, and we can let that velocity dictate what's on the bar, and then we can get that competitive element in there by providing leaderboards, by just, you know, setting up loads that are similar across individuals. That means that they're then trying to beat their mate by getting a quicker score. It's the whole, you know, gamification, I suppose, of the weight room, which through technology is a lot easier these days to be able to do that. And we can, you know, you can do jump height and force plates. You can do it with anything really in terms of jump distance or now velocity. So we can set up a leaderboard, top gets a prize, bottom gets whatever, and create almost a healthy competitive environment that players then start to buy into. And I think that's the biggest, or one of the biggest impacts I've seen from a VBP perspective, is the buy-in that you can get from players who typically don't like being in the gym. And I don't criticize those players, because I get it, they're there to play football, and if all they want to do is be out on the field with the ball at their feet, then they might use that opportunity to turn off and kind of just switch off a little bit. So, you know, it's no criticism of the player, it's about us as practitioners being able to build an environment that encourages them to compete and to engage in that process, that makes it enjoyable and entertaining and kind of interesting for them and gives them a different focus. And yeah, the feedback space and approach, I think, can be really, really powerful.
I think it underlines here as well that importance of tech within this scenario, doesn't it? Because you mentioned there about, obviously, we can use things like jumps, jump height, jump distance, things like that have been used for a long time. But if we're taking a lift and telling players to move as fast as they can without the tech, without that feedback, that's going to be very, very different to actually having numbers in front of them and making it competitive, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And it does. There's reams of research out there these days that shows the difference between feedback versus no feedback, or from a rep by rep perspective in terms of that output, from a week by week perspective, but then also the impact that can have on pre-post performance testing data like jumps and 1RMs, 3RMs, sprints, etc. And everything leans towards feedback. There's a really cool meta-analysis by Dr. Jonathan Weekly, who's based out in Australia, and they found that they kind of meta-analyzed all of the velocity-based feedback research and found that on average there is an 8.4% increase in performance, whether that's acute or chronic, simply by providing some feedback. So wow. Simply by stood there with a device, either letting the athlete see it, or you with the device yourself saying, you know, 1.5, 1.52, 1.54, and getting them to react to that and respond to that, it can, like I said, it can be really, really powerful and can get you those 1-2% potentially that you're trying to find when you're up in the sort of echelons of sport and sporting performance. It can be really, really impactful.
When you've worked with players, so obviously before we had this sort of technology, we'd be working with players trying to improve strength. Obviously, you mentioned before about some of the cultural issues within football and battling players to get away from thinking of any lifting, any sort of weight makes them sore. But if we come beyond that, and you've got players that know the value of getting stronger, but haven't necessarily stepped into the world of VBT or focusing on velocity, how have you found that sort of change to say, right, it's not strictly about external load on the bar now, it's about how fast we move. Can you do that in a session? Does it take a little bit of learning? How do you find that?
It takes a little bit of learning. I think, you know, the best way to do this, and I was reading something maybe just this morning about kind of, or maybe it was a video on Instagram or something about almost drip feeding this in. If you're in an established program, it's like anything, you don't come in and then completely change things because that'll just throw everyone off. So it's almost like drip feeding it in. So teach them how to use the device, then get them to measure velocity. If they're already kind of bought into lifting heavy and getting stronger, or not even lifting heavy, but lifting with intent, let's call it, and not being afraid to load up when it's the right time, then I think actually the impact that velocity can have can be more of an educational piece for them to either help them figure out how to step back a little bit if we're in a -1, a -2 day, and we're trying to get a little stimulus, but we don't want to break the bank. But also, you know, they might think that they're strong, but perhaps they're strong in terms of what they've experienced, and we can use the velocity then to say, well, you know, we want you, the research suggests that you should be at a 0.4 to 0.5 meters per second for this load, for the aim of this session, but actually the load that you typically lift, you're at 0.6. So you can lift more, put that on, try that, do it with intent, and suddenly you get that sort of light bulb moment of, actually, I'm stronger than I thought I was, and I can push on even more. So there's so many kind of angles to use with players across that whole spectrum of hate the gym to absolutely love the gym and want to spend more time in there. So many different avenues you can explore with VBT to get more out of that player, which is why I love it, which is why I think it can be so effective, because it is really flexible, multidimensional, and can be really, really effective in those different scenarios.
With your experience with other athletes or other sports where you've potentially used VBT as well, how does football differ? Does it differ?
I don't think it does. I think everybody, you know, athletes are competitive in nature. So, you know, we used it, or we do use it with the divers quite religiously. And, you know, previously we created an environment that was just as competitive as it would be within a football club. Through different means, and I think ultimately the, you know, athletes are competitive and they want to win. That's why they're athletes. So if we can do that in the right way in other aspects of their training, as opposed to just, you know, competition and, you know, the actual competing in that sport, then you're always going to get that extra buy-in, I think. And you know, the divers we've worked with are great athletes. You know, they move extremely well, their coordination is second to none, and their attitude is brilliant. But even then, by implementing VBT over the years, we've always just got that little bit more out of the program, and we've always been able to sort of get those extra 1, 2, 5, 10% when we need it.
Yeah, brilliant. What about some of the challenges that you might face incorporating this? Because I know there'll be people listening that either use it and might come across some challenges, something that you might have faced before within squads.
anyone that's worked in football knows what it's like having a squad of players in the gym anyway. So it could be that in itself. But if you were to sort of make people aware of some of the challenges that you face, what sort of things would you bring up?
Yeah, I think knowing the environment, knowing when to use it and when not to use it. So it can't be done in every exercise. It's just not feasible. So pick the key exercises, whether that's one, whether it's two, whether it's lower or upper body. Just pick the key exercise and go with that. And then it's a case of thinking about the setup of the space. So typically most clubs, organizations might have 2, 3, 4 devices if they're lucky. Even those that I've worked with that have an all right budget don't tend to have one per athlete or one per player. So it's making sure that you're set up in the right way. So it might be, for example, grouping players based on their strength. So you might have a strong, a kind of a medium, and then a not so strong group. And if you can marry them up in 2 or 3 separate groups, have the device on the bar, everybody's doing the same exercise, it's just a case of flipping through the phone or the iPad, the right person, right load on, do your load, your set, and then move on to the next person. And that can become really, it can be autonomous within the players, so they can look after that once they've upskilled on it. They can then take care of that, and as a coach, you can then sort of move around the gym and make sure that the session is what it should be in your head. But also, it means that players are not waiting around too long for someone to finish with the device, do all their sets, and finish with the device and stuff. So, you know, it's nothing groundbreaking. It's just simple weight room management, really, in terms of how you might set up a session. And then you've got the typical technological challenges where you might not have charged it. It might not connect for some reason. There might be something, it might miss reps. They're the sort of thing they're just part and parcel of using technology. Unfortunately, you can't always get away from them. You've just got to manage it and just sort of roll the punches a little bit. But if once you become well-versed in that tech, normally you can troubleshoot and you can fix things pretty quickly. Obviously, sort of a simple message, but just spend some time with the device, use it on yourself, and make sure you understand how it should be used. Then, if you are in an intense environment and the players are in the middle of something and something goes wrong, you can fix it.
You mentioned about the selection of exercises you use it on. Obviously, not trying to use it on everything, but if we're pinning down, look, sort of 1 or 2 exercises for the session. Do you have anything that you lean towards? Would you give any sort of advice on where coaches should focus their time in terms of EPT?
Yeah, I think you know, programs look if we're taking a real magnifying glass out and zooming out and looking at all the programs being delivered across a sport or even multiple sports, you know, they're going to have similar themes in there. There's going to be a lower body strength, there's going to be a lower body power, there's going to be an upper push and a pull and that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, I have ones that I typically navigate to. So back squats, your jump squats, trap bar deadlift, split squat, for example, and then maybe some kind of bench and some bench pull, something like that. But I don't think the exercise itself is the important thing. It's making sure that exercise is consistent across the program. So there's no point, we're kind of maybe getting into the weeds of profiling a little bit, but you know, if you're going to spend lots of time profiling a back squat, do that for 6 weeks and then get rid of the back squat and start doing something else that's quite different. Well, that's going to have a completely different profile, and therefore you're going to have to go through that same process again. It's going to take time out of the program and it becomes a little bit inefficient. So I think if you can have an overview of what your program might look like for a few months or even for a full season, and you know that there's going to be a key exercise or variation of an exercise within that, then that for me is the obvious choice to delve into the VBT. and make sure that you're collecting that data as consistently as you can. So yeah, I suppose it's based on individual preference of that program, really.
Yeah, brilliant. Just on the challenges again, just around the competition side, is there anything that you've come across with a squad of players in terms of that competitive environment, or have you always found it pretty positive?
Yeah, so it's interesting, actually. I did, as part of my PhD, I did a qualitative piece of research. I was lucky enough to do it in COVID, so everyone had loads of time. So I had the chance to really top coaches all over the world, some in football. And a couple of we explored the benefits, but also explored the drawback of using VBT in different forms. And one of the bits of feedback that we got was actually that within that competitive environment, if you're bottom of that leaderboard every time, then it can actually have a little bit of a negative impact.
Yeah.
Because players were actually then missing out that exercise because they didn't want to be bottom of the leaderboard. Because they are competitive, nobody wants to be last, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a balancing act, really, in terms of when it's used, how much emphasis you put on that competition and that leaderboard, and then almost thinking about ways in which you can select exercises or approaches that would maybe complement different people or players within that environment. So you might have someone that perhaps isn't the strongest, but you know, give them an unloaded jump squat, and they can maximize the peak velocity. So actually, they'll be top of the leaderboard for that one, but might be bottom of the leaderboard for the strength one. And I suppose just trying to think about the players in front of you and the athletes in front of you and how they might feel about being bottom. If you've got a squad that you know, it's all about kind of ripping each other and there's no personalities in there that are the quiet ones that perhaps don't really, you know, none of them really care if they're bottom. It's just all good kind of sort of jovial banter or whatever. Then perhaps you don't need to worry. But if you do have those players that maybe naturally migrate to the quieter side and don't necessarily like that kind of interaction, then that's probably just something to be mindful of and how you set that up.
Would it be something that you'd possibly encourage? Obviously, there's the competition within the squad is going to, when you get the positives out, that's going to be massive, isn't it? But is it possibly something you'd lean towards, like an individual target in terms of beating yourself? So yeah, like saying that this is what you got a few weeks ago, look how much faster we, yes, you're still bottom of the pile or whatever it is, but look at the speed increase now.
Yeah, I think that's a key part of it as well. And you know, competition with oneself as opposed to with teammates can be just as powerful. And I think, you know, that is a really useful testing tool that I think often gets overlooked, is, you know, standardize a load and use that as your pre-post testing and look at the velocity. If that velocity gets faster, we know that they've got stronger. You know, simple physics, Newtonian laws, force equals mass times acceleration. We know that if acceleration increases, that's a derivative of velocity. We know that mass stays the same. So if that whole equation goes up, force increases, force underpins strength, and therefore they've got stronger. Yes, we might not be able to quantify that in the same way that we would do if we did a 1RM or a 3RM, for example, but we can at least say to the athlete, to the coaches, and to yourself, well, the program's working. You're getting stronger, you're getting faster, so we're moving in the right direction. And it can be a good way of then selling it to those that perhaps are not as competitive within that squad leader.
Brilliant, mate. So much in this one today for coaches to take away. So I really appreciate you doing it, Steve. In terms of the work that you've got out, just general updates with yourself, where would you direct people to keep up to date with what you're got going on?
Yeah, typically just X. We're calling it X now, aren't we?
Right? I can't do it.
Twitter. So that my handle at Steve381 is probably the best place to see what I'm doing and get in touch. And if anybody's interested in my research, then you can always find my research gate as well.
Awesome, mate. Thanks a lot for your time.
Pleasure, mate. Thanks for having me on. It's been really enjoyable.
Big thank you to Steve for coming on. It was great to catch up with him. It's been a little while since I saw him at the event, and it was great to catch up on the phone recently just to discuss some of the things we were going to talk about in the podcast. And he certainly didn't disappoint. I'm sure you've taken plenty away from this episode. So please, as always, go and give it a share on any of the social media platforms or send it into WhatsApp groups, however you can share the episode and get it into as many people's ears and eyes as possible. That would be very much appreciated. Go and link up with Steve as well. He's over on LinkedIn. Just search Steve Thompson. And also over on, I can't say X, it's Twitter. He's at Steve381 over on Twitter. So go and give him a follow to keep up to date with some of the things he's got going on. As always, some of the takeaways from me. I think the interesting one from Steve's perspective is the debate around what you take in terms of academia and in terms of the applied world, how much crosses over, and the fact that you talked about everything being research informed in terms of carrying that over into the applied world. So I thought that made complete sense. I know some people, like you mentioned, they want to get stuck into it, they want to be on the front line, they want to be working and really working in that applied setting and not focusing so much on the research. But I think it is important. We need to be up to date with what's going on in terms of the research and the whole phrase of research informed. It's not strictly focusing on every detail of the research, but it's informed by research. I think that's a really good point. He spoke about having the specialist area, which I think was a great point. So obviously for Steve with velocity-based training, that isn't the only thing that Steve is going to be doing within his roles, but the fact that he can speak so confidently about it on a podcast, he can give some great information, and he becomes known as someone that if you've got any questions around velocity-based training, he's probably going to be one of the people up there that you're going to reach out to. So I think that alone creates like a profile, and it makes you become aware to a lot more people because there's a reason for them to know about you. So I think that in terms of advice for coaches is some key advice. And obviously it doesn't have to be on the same topic. But if you've got an area that you can sort of niche into, as well as having the generalist skills that you need to carry into different roles, I think that's really important. And then the great phrase that he used around best practice. So he said best practice was basically whatever fits the environment. And I thought that absolutely summarizes the majority of roles out there, especially within football, because it's not going to be a case of you going into a role and just taking like a blueprint of what someone else has done or what you've done in a previous role and just dropping it into a new role, because there's a lot of logistics, there's a lot of sort of complexities around each individual role. So you've got to understand that, and then the best practice is whatever fits into that. And I thought you summarized that really nicely. So they're the takeaways from me. As always, I'd love to hear yours. So when you are sharing the episode, please post a little bit about what you took from it. I know some people have done some great posts on that recently, so I really appreciate it. And then just finally, make sure to go and check out our sponsors. They're doing some incredible work, these companies, Rezl, Hytro, and The Good Prep. Go and give them all a follow on social media and show them some love. And I will speak to you again in episode 284.